It's another Monday and another episode of The Inadequate Life, the podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's episode, Steve Cohen. Steve's been entertaining people with his unusual and very extraordinary magical feats at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. He's developed a reputation around the world as being one of the finest close-up magicians anywhere of all time, and he's on the show today. I'm totally excited Steve Cohen is here to talk about his show, Chamber Magic. That's coming up on The Inadequate Life with me, Keith Tomasek. Hey, thanks so much for tuning in again today. That's such an archaic word, tuning in. You're not really tuning in. Thanks for listening in on your podcast on iTunes. We're on Stitcher now. I'm totally excited about that. You can get us on your favorite podcast catcher. So I use, on my Android, I use Beyond Pod. It's a wonderful tool to pick up podcasts. And I don't know if I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but years ago I used to do magic. I mean, like so many people in the evolution of the performing arts, people like Jimmy Stewart, people like Johnny Carson, people like Orson Welles did magic in their youth. And it's a wonderful way to learn and build confidence for young people. Magic permits you to get up in front of people to sort of have a secret, but entertain people at the same time. And it also teaches you an amazing respect and camaraderie, the fraternity of magicians, which is sort of brought together by this amazing bond of secrecy, is unlike any other fraternity I've ever been a part of. And as a youth growing up in Montreal, the people that I hung out with in terms of my sort of male role models were older magicians. You know, I was not into sports and I wasn't into, my model trains or collecting things, but I was into collecting magic tricks. And every weekend, my mom would drive me to the little magic shop, and I'd get to go and watch and learn from men older than myself, some of whom took me under their wing. In Montreal, there's a very famous magician named Tom Auburn who had a TV show, and I used to watch his TV show as a kid, awestruck in grade 4 and 5 by all the magic he did, and I'd go see him perform live, and then I became friends with him, and he actually gave me a collection of amazing manuscripts and books later in life, and he was kind enough to come to my my high school variety show and watch me perform there, and it was just an amazing... And this, he was like a superstar in the world of magic in Montreal. And internationally, or certainly in North America, Tom Auburn was known and recognized, so I certainly wouldn't have developed as a young boy and a young man without the support from Tom. And I actually got to spend time with him in his office, and he would teach me tricks and things. It was quite a great relationship. Anyway, so all that to say, I wouldn't be where I am now without my interest and keen love of magic. And today's guest is just celebrated around the world as being the most innovative and probably the smartest guy when it comes to close-up magic right now. I met with him in Toronto. He's in Toronto for the Luminato Festival. He's doing a couple of performances, and hopefully you have a chance to attend those if you're listening in time. Before we get to that, I wanted to just give a shout out to my sponsor, Karen Hartwick. As you know, I'm a consummate tea beverage consumer. I love tea, not a coffee guy. If you like tea as much as I do, please go to StratfordTeaLeaves.com. Check it out. It's a great site. Karen's a kind and generous sponsor of this program. And if you love tea as much as I do, you'll definitely want to check it out. You can order online, or if you're in Stratford, drop by and say hi. Karen actually travels the world and goes to the tea plantations and meets the people who grow the tea and hand selects it herself. Sometimes she actually works the tea leaves. Anyway, tea leaves, StratfordTeaLeaves.com. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy the podcast. And don't forget, next week, I believe, Shalina Kennedy, who is on Broadway with Jesus Christ Superstar and is currently in Evangeline at the Charlottetown Festival next week. Right now, the amazing Steve Cohen. Thanks for taking the time to be on the podcast while you're here in Toronto. How long are you in for?
I just got in today. Thanks for inviting me on to your talk. I'll be here until Thursday, and that means I'll be here for full days, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And each one of those days, I have two performances, so 7 o'clock and 9:30 each one of those days. So two performances each night.
What do people who are coming to the show, what can they, or people who are interested in seeing the show, if not here in New York, what can they expect to see? There's video a bit online and that sort of stuff, but how would you describe it?
Well, my show is called Chamber Magic, and it's actually a throwback to the type of magic that used to be performed in the 19th century. It's close-up magic. I suppose you can call it close-up magic, or more appropriately, parlor magic, because it's the type of magic that might have been seen in someone's living room. A wealthy person might have invited friends over for a special soiree, a nice evening dinner, and then move everyone into the parlor or their living room and have a hired gun, a performer, an entertainer come in and entertain and dazzle their guests. You might be familiar with Mark Twain, who used to do these after-dinner talks.
Of course.
And it was very similar to that, whereas, you know, it was a formal presentation, but it was also engaging,
sure,
because everyone who's there gets to become part of the show. So in my shows at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, which is my home base for the past 13 years, we have only between 50 and 55 people per show. Here I think we're going to have a little bit more, maybe around like 60 or 65, something in that neighborhood, per performance. But because there's such a small group, I mean, that's a really intimate group, everyone really feels like they're actually part of the show. And not only do they feel it, but I actually move them around. I have people stand up and gather around me. People come in real close. They're holding things, doing things, touching things, and actually experiencing the magic themselves.
It sounds like it is an amazingly unique experience in the magical world, and it brings us back to a time, like you said, where people would do magic in their parlor, hence the term parlor magic.
Yeah, parlor magic is you know, it's a well-known expression in the field of magic. Another title for it would be called salon magic, because the salon or the parlor, you know, we're kind of equivalent in different parts of Europe,
yeah,
right?
I think
because
of France.
Right, the salons, in, like you say, in France, but also in Austria. And one of my biggest inspirations was an Austrian magician who was very popular in Vienna in the late 19th century. His name was Johann Hofsenzer. And Hofsenzer really is considered to be one of the true artists of magic. He specialized in parlor magic. That was his whole deal. And in fact, his career has spanned, I believe, it was something like nearly 20 years of performing for small, intimate groups, but of the elite of the society in Vienna. And so when I was putting together my show, I thought, what could I do in New York that would make it unique? And, you know, I had gone for many, many years working at people's parties, as you know, just what they could say, you know, gigs, working at gigs.
Table hopping.
I didn't do very much table hopping, but you know, I would do like, you know, people would hire me to do a performance at a party for their you know, their best guests.
Right.
But the problem with that is that, you know, after each performance, you're basically unemployed.
Of course.
So, yeah, you know, what's the point of really trying to perfect your craft if you don't even know when your next show is?
You're just waiting for the phone to ring. You're
correct.
Not master of your own destiny.
It's kind of like being a taxi driver. Right? You're a taxi driver, yes.
Jeez, great analogy.
They're waiting for the next person to raise their hand and hail down their cab. But until that, in between, they're basically unemployed. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if I could take the ideas of Hofsenzer, this magician from Vienna, and bring them into the current day,
right,
and do a salon-style show in New York City. And, of course, this is the show I'm doing here in Toronto also. But the show, the genesis of the show, it began in 2000, so 13 years ago. And I began it in my friend's apartment in Greenwich Village, in the West Village in New York City.
Yeah, I read about that.
Yeah, and the reason was because I didn't really have a venue. Like, my first idea
was that Harvey Cohen? Is that who?
Harvey Cohen, not related in any way. Yeah,
sure.
We happen to share the same last name, and he also was a great magician. Unfortunately, he passed away recently. Harvey was kind enough to say, sure, you can use my apartment as the venue
in
Greenwich Village. So I used to invite people from my mailing list, saying, would you like to come see my new show? And for the first couple of weeks, two or three weeks, I had a steady stream of customers. But then his wife said, you know, you can't keep on inviting people into our house.
The generous old man.
Exactly.
And his wife's like, okay, enough.
Right,
enough.
I mean, you're rearranging the furniture every week. It's
so
it's a big
beautiful
hassle.
Yeah.
So I kind of got kicked out, and I was out on the street.
Now, that's so he was a patron of the arts in the true sense.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, he truly was. I mean, he certainly, you know, inspired me to by giving me a location,
sure,
and not charging me for the rent,
right,
you know,
yeah,
or you know, theater rental.
And bless the people of New York City, because when I think of magic, I mean, in the contemporary I say contemporary. I'm just talking about my life. I'm 50. So in the period of magic in my life, like I actually do remember seeing magicians on Ed Sullivan, but that was a long time ago. But mostly we think of, or I think of Doug Henning and how he transformed magic to the popular television audience. You know, there was that period when he went from, you know, obviously New York. That's the amazing thing I was going to bring up was
He started from Canada. Don't forget that.
Well, that's true. Yeah, Toronto.
He's from
right
Winnipeg.
Here. Yeah, yeah, Winnipeg and then Toronto. And then, but so it was New York that allowed him to do Spellbound and then the magic show and grow. And the other people I think of in terms of hugely changing magic are Penn and Teller. And they were, you know, New York was really good to those guys too. I remember seeing them ages and ages ago in New York City. So it's almost like it's a great place for someone to be able to grow and experiment and be creative and make, you know, obviously you make mistakes in the path when you try to get where you're going. But so Harvey and Cohen was just a patron and you were lucky to have found him.
Right, I agree. Well, you know, one of the things about New York is that people are always looking for something to do.
Sure.
And they're...
Well, there's a lot to do. And I'm adding you to that list, by the way, of people that have sort of transformed magic and brought it to the masses in a different way. So Henning, for sure. And then after him, I'd say, you know, Copperfield followed in terms of television, but I think Henning was the guy that really brought it around. And then Penn and Teller were just so innovative and creative. And initially, there were small houses. I remember the theater that I saw them in.
You saw them at the West Side Arts Theater, probably.
It was a small theater, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that there, too, in the 80s. It was wonderful.
Yeah. You're in New York City doing the same thing in terms of creatively on equally large level, but to fewer bodies at one time.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I've already done the show for over 300,000 people.
That's amazing.
So that's if you could count it, you know, if you divide it out by 50 or 60 people per shows, I've done thousands and thousands of performances, and I've counted now over 3,000 performances.
At the Waldorf.
And, you know, it's by design that I do it for small groups. It's not because I can't pull in bigger houses. In fact, I did the show at Carnegie Hall.
Oh, wow.
Last January. I was the first magician in about 40 years to do a magic show in Carnegie Hall. But I believe that magic is best seen up close when there's no barriers, there's no distraction, there's no orchestra pit between the front row and me. I'm literally
right there in their face.
You know, a foot or two away from you.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people who are sitting in the front row, there's just no barrier. There's not even, you know, there's no glass sheet. We're right there. And the interaction is two-way. And it's not like you go to see a show where you just sit back and let the actors on stage.
Yeah, proscenium. There's the proscenium.
Right.
There we are.
It's completely interactive. So I think that's what people like. And I think that that's one of the reasons I've had a success is because New Yorkers want to go out. People who aren't from New York but who are visiting New York have the intent to go out and be entertained.
Are we sure? Yeah.
Right? And so I have people from all over the world who come in. I mean, every show.
Yeah.
Remember, I'm doing 5 shows a week, 250 shows a year, and I've got people at every show, all different languages, you know, people from South America, from Asia, from Europe, and as far away as Canada.
Here we are.
And so we have people, you know, from everywhere.
So going back to Harvey Cohen, at the time you were developing this show, how did you start in magic? What were your early days? And like for me, I did everyone I spoke to did birthday parties at some point. You know, you'd show up at a kid's party.
I performed at some birthday parties. Sure,
my
the beginning of magic for me, one of the way I got involved in this this glorious art, is when I was 6 years old. My uncle was an amateur magician.
Okay.
Showed me a trick, and he did a card trick. It was wonderful. He also showed me a trick, which is using a little black stick that had different colored gemstones on it, called the hot rod.
Mm-hmm.
And he changed all those different colored gemstones all into diamonds.
Right. So you're 6 years old. You're blown away.
And I was just fascinated. And so I said, you know, Uncle Nat, can you teach me how you did that? And so he had a lot of nephews and nieces. He showed all of his tricks to every one of them, but I was the only one who paid attention. So he took me off into a corner and he would show me how he did these tricks, and he'd give me the props that he used.
Wow.
And then every time we had a family gathering, we would repeat that, and he would show, you know, everyone something. Then he'd pull me aside and teach me the secret. And so over the years, I started to accumulate these little gadgets and these little tricks that I could do. But then he said, I think you're ready now. And he gave me a magic book. And I still have this book. It's from the 1890s. I believe it was 1897 it was published. It's called Tricks with Cards by Professor Hoffman.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've heard of Professor
Hoffman. Professor Hoffman was one of the very first authors who recorded the true secrets of magic. You know, not just, you know, gags or jokes, but real, you know, what
effects
with the is the techniques that professional conjurers of the day were using.
Sure.
And it was pure, you know, illustrated with these beautiful wood cut etchings and whatnot. And it was really an amazing book. So I took that book, and now, by the way, now, after all these years, the pages of the book are deteriorating to such a degree that as I turn each page, it crumbles into dust in my hands.
That's so a very valuable book.
Yeah, it's almost it's almost like, you know, the Ark of the Covenant and you know, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, when you see it just like break into dust. That's what's happening to this book that started me off.
So and so age six and on, and then when did you first realize? I remember when I was a kid at Christmas time, making, this is a long time ago, making literally thousands of dollars because Christmas was the busy time of year for the magic shows. Do two or three shows on a Saturday, two or three shows on a Sunday. If you're lucky, you got 3 weekends before the holiday.
Hey, you're pretty serious about this. You were making thousands of dollars back in the 70s.
Back, yeah, well, yeah, I was busy in Montreal. You could do 3 shows a day. If I was lucky, I'd get 3 shows a day.
How did you get around from place to place?
You know what? Part of my deal was they'd always have to pick me up.
Okay.
Isn't that crazy?
So I had a different deal. So my deal was I get paid whatever it was. And my before I could drive, my parents drove me around.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's why, you know, today's Father's Day when we're recording this. And I saw my father this morning before I left New York. And I thanked him because, really, I would not have been able to even be here at Luminato or doing my shows at the Waldorf if I hadn't had those early opportunities, which were really provided and facilitated by my dad.
Of course, and, driving you know, around. And then you have to hang around for the whole thing.
Exactly. He would drop me off. I would do this show. He'd wait. And then he'd wait for me to pack everything up.
It's a long
get paid and you know, pack everything back into his car. So, you know, that's a dedicated family. And my parents have always been very supportive.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, as I do the podcast and I talk to, the more I talk to people about the creative process and how they achieved the success that they've achieved, support networks invariably always come up. And for me as a young boy, my mother was a single mother. So the magic community was actually part of that support network for me as a young guy growing up. As I look back on my youth now, you know, the most important male role models were the people in the magic fraternity.
Right. Could be kind of creepy having, you know, magicians being your only role models. But I have to be honest, though, I would share my experience, although I come from a traditional family. You know, my best friends were all, when I was like in my teens, all my best friends were in their 50s and 60s.
Right. Yeah.
They're older than my own parents practically because they were these, you know, seasoned magicians who saw that I was serious about this. And they respected because magic is a meritocracy.
Correct.
You know, if you have not just a desire to learn the secrets, but the drive to put in the hours and to truly, you know, perfect something and then be able to show it to other people and share it, then magicians, you know, magicians like myself now who are professionals, can recognize that because we know how hard it is to get to that stage.
Yeah.
And so I can easily weed out people who are just, you know, secret, you know, the people who wonder about the secrets versus people who are truly interested in
art and the craft,
furthering their understanding of magic. Right. I was really lucky early on that my parents allowed me to hang out with these kind of, you know, these older guys.
And they don't know who they are.
They don't know who they are. Yeah. I remember one time I went to a magician's conference. They have conventions just like any field.
Yeah.
And there is a conference that, and by the way, magicians' conferences are great because it's for a whole weekend in a hotel, and magicians are doing tricks for each other in the lobby, and then they have shows in the ballroom, and they've got, you know, just magic constantly
everywhere,
teaching each other in lecture halls. But I remember going to one of these conventions with my dad, and he hung around and watched the whole thing with me
for the
weekend, and then came back home, and then I went to sleep that night at home, and I heard through my bedroom door, I heard my parents talking to each other.
Wow. So your dad figured out this is for real?
Well, no. What my dad said, he says, I don't want him interacting with those people any longer.
Oh, my God.
They're all a bunch of freaks.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, okay.
It's like what happened after that?
And I kind of just pretended I didn't hear that conversation.
But that's great, though. And let me go ahead.
I do have some more to that story. And, you know, in a way, I understand because, you know, when you're outside of any field, whether it's magic or dog breeders.
Yeah, dog breeders is a great example.
Or any
horse people.
Yeah, exactly. Horse people or people who are involved in the ballet.
Sure.
You know, anyone who has any deep interest in something is going to be a little off center that's their world. Their world is separate from, you know, from the average public. So you know, when my dad said they're a bunch of freaks, you know, I don't think he was talking about magicians in general, although there are some oddballs, certainly.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
To be expected. But you know, like I said, in any field, I mean, you know, you're in academia. The more you get ensconced
in your particular
field, you know, everyone else thinks, well, that guy is such an oddball.
And you have less time for the real world to
Correct.
Fit in. And in case of magicians, many of them only fit into the real world if they're actually doing magic, which is a whole other thing. But the funny thing about two great things you made me think of about parents. So I have, my mom was a single mother, so she couldn't come with me. But when I was, I think, either 15 or 16, I don't remember the year, she trusted some of those older magician guys that were part of our community to take me to the Waldorf Astoria, to the SAM convention.
And it was 1978.
Yeah, that's when it was, 78. So I would have been 15. I was 15 years old.
Yeah, that was a great convention. I was not. I was only 7 years old at the time, so okay. I couldn't go to it, obviously.
So your dad could take it. She just trusted these guys well enough to say, go to New York City.
Right, it was at the Waldorf Astoria.
Since
well, that, I've been doing a lot of research about magicians who have performed at the Waldorf.
Hmm. Oh, that's a great idea.
And I wrote a blog post about this, so maybe I'll, if you have a blog entry.
You could link to it, sure.
I'll link you to that page. But there have been many, many magicians over the past, 70 or 80 years who performed in the Waldorf. But going back even to the original Waldorf Astoria Hotel, which was not in its current location on Park Avenue, but it was in the current location of the Empire State Building.
Hmm.
The Empire State Building is on 32nd Street.
Wasn't that built like in the 30s?
Sorry, 34th Street and 5th Avenue. Yeah. And 34th and 5th Avenue, at that exact corner, was the original Waldorf Astoria Hotel.
Hmm.
It's actually two hotels that they joined together. And Max Mellini, one of my other heroes, famous magician, very famous magician, one of the most famous, actually, used to perform in the old Waldorf. And I have some memorabilia from the Waldorf Astoria Hotel that proves that he was actually performing
there.
That's
very cool, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
So the other thing, when we were getting onto the sort of magicians and your dad's perception of a magician, I read something about Dick Cavett introducing you at the National Arts Club in New York. And he, of course, Dick Cavett's a great magician, and he introduced me and many others to people like Sly Dean and all of the guys he'd have on. But Cavett said, these are his words, every art has a lot of crappiness. So talk about, you did talk a little bit about the downside of magicians, because along the road, some of the guys that I met were the kind of guys you described. They almost felt like used car salesmen. You know, they were trying to fool people for their own benefit as opposed to creating a memorable experience that made people think about what was going on.
Right. I think that, magic is, like many performing arts, it's not about how it makes me feel, but it's about the emotion that I'm conveying to you as an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment that, well, I'll back that up by saying, unfortunately, the reason that people often get into magic when they're younger is because they're insecure and they don't necessarily have an outlet to interact with people.
Right.
So magic suddenly gives them this golden ticket to be able to walk up to someone and start interacting with them. And then the person doesn't just walk away because they want to know how the trick ends.
Sure.
But then again, the trick then is, or the magic, I should say, is all about me, me, me.
Right.
Like, oh, look what it did for me. I'm great. And now my ego has risen.
Right.
Because of my, having learned how to do this one trick.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, people grow up this way. Young magicians grow up this way. And they don't change the purpose of why they're performing. And if the trick continues to be all about me, 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 when you're an adult, and if you're ever trying to become a professional magician, I don't think people are going to be that ingratiated to you.
No.
Because
engaged.
You're not making them feel good.
Right, right.
And so one of the great expressions, I think, is not just being a magician, but being a magical entertainer.
Mm-hmm.
And, an entertainer, if you go to Las Vegas or go to any, if you look at anyone throughout history who's considered to be a great entertainer, let's say, even people who have, personal foibles. Let's take someone like Danny Kaye. Right?
Sure. Yeah.
Danny Kaye, people say awful things about how he was off stage, but that guy, when he goes in front of a crowd, you'll watch him in any of his movies or any television appearances, he made you just laugh and giggle with glee.
Yeah. And forget about life. Forget about your own problems. Because that was probably the only time he could forget about his problems, too, when he was on stage.
Right, and so I think that the job of a great magician is to take people out of their daily existence and make them feel like they're living in a dream.
Yeah.
And the dream is happening, and they're actually living inside of it.
So you
it's almost like a guided dream.
Wow, very cool. Yeah, well, that's certainly when I think of the best work of Penn and Teller. One of their most recent bits I saw them do, where they're using videotape. Not only are they guiding you through your own dream, but they're using video to misdirect you. They're forcing you to look at a video screen.
Oh, that's
doing
great.
Doing things right live.
That's really terrific.
That's the most amazing thing I've seen recently, really, because I don't get to see a lot of magic.
Did you see them do that in Las Vegas?
No, I saw them do it on the road. I'd love to see that.
Okay,
have you seen that?
Yeah,
it's
wonderful. It's a really great
It was
great
the most
piece.
Amazing thing. And I teach filmmaking, too, so I'm aware of filmmaking and I'm aware of magic.
Yeah, they really nailed it. It fooled me, too.
I was so fooled.
After it was over, I was like, oh, okay, I see where they're leading me. And I think the most intelligent people would watch that and they could potentially backtrack a little bit of it, but it's still a real baffling.
Oh, and the thing about Penn and Teller's work and any good work like you're talking about is even if you start to backtrack, you're still just going to appreciate it for its beauty and for the moment and the way it's taken you away from whatever it is.
Right,
and you're not
right.
just thinking, how did they do that? How did they do that? You're actually in the moment and and enjoying it with them because the performer's in, you know, having a good time.
Right. But, you know, having said that, though, this is not all fun and games. I mean, you know, being a magician, you know, you really have to think, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 steps ahead of the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
So that not only are you thinking about baffling them at the moment, but making it impossible to penetrate even after they think about it weeks later.
And after they may have seen it again.
Correct. So I've got people who come back to see my show in New York multiple times, and every time they come back, they're bringing different people.
Right.
One guy actually keeps on bringing back different girlfriends every time.
Oh, no.
Yeah, a different girlfriend every show. He's been back like 9 times.
Oh.
And I recognize this guy, and every time after the show, he comes over to me, and he's like, oh, Steve, it's nice to meet you, you know? And he's like, I'd like to introduce you to someone very special.
Oh, no.
The same guy every time. Like, oh, this is just a little too creepy for me. But, you know, as a magician, I'm thinking of the logical disconnect so that, you know, people, when they're watching this, can't figure out how it's done, even after repeated viewing. And also after, you know, thorough examination of their recollection of what they saw.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in that way, it's kind of like creating a locked room mystery. And, you know, you want to make that so it's completely impenetrable. And I think that's one of the reasons why I get a lot of, you know, wealthy and smart people who come to the show, people who have really the top of their field.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm known as the millionaire's magician.
I love it. Yeah.
And the people who come to my show truly are, you know, the captains of industry, top in the A-list celebrities.
Yeah, if they can't figure it out, they've got people around them who can tell them and advise them.
Exactly.
This is how we do it. We'll succeed.
You know,
we'll, you know,
the world's billionaires. I looked at the top billionaires list in America. You know, I've performed for nearly half the list. I mean,
sure.
it's pretty it's
and
ridiculous.
And I've read about some of the international people you've
entertained.
Exactly.
And I've, I do shows in Europe and all over the world. So, and I used to live in Japan, so I do lots of shows in Asia. So the people who are coming to the show are really smart.
Right.
Really smart. You know, and but I think one of the reasons that they want to see magic at all, why would someone who's brilliant or someone who can, you know, really have anything want to watch a magic show? And I think that the reason is because at some point, it's fun for the mental challenge, but also it's an escape.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because there's so much pressure on successful people.
Of course. Yeah.
And to be able for just a short time to be able to, you know, step aside or step away from all that pressure and just not know.
Yeah.
It's
and,
actually
and be
quite
delighted,
liberating.
Be delighted, have a joyful experience.
I've seen, you know, people who are literally, I'm talking, you know, the world's top billionaires who come to see me, and I see their faces look at me in the beginning like, come on, pal, show me something I've never seen before. And then 5 minutes into it, they're like, they're grinning like little children.
Right, yeah.
And it's really exciting to see that transformation because, you know, I see the skepticism melt away.
Right. It's a beautiful thing. Hey, so here's a question. I want to go back to the, because you mentioned Japan, to how you managed to go from Harvey Cohen's apartment in Greenwich Village. So at that time, were you able, because making a living is, I mean, in any performing arts, making a living and, you know, raising a family and evolving that way is difficult and challenging at the best of times. So, and it's even tougher, I'd say, for people who are sort of contract workers like magicians who are by yourself. It's not like you can become part of a touring company. So talk a bit about when you were doing the Harvey Cohen apartment show in Greenwich and you realized, hey, there's an audience for me. There's a potential revenue stream. Did you have a job? Were you working as a translator?
That's the time when I was working as a translator, yes.
So full-time job doing all these shows at night as well.
So what I was doing at the time was I was working as a translator because I just moved back from Tokyo. And, you know, it was a pretty lucrative job. I didn't enjoy it. Because sitting in front of a computer and looking at legal documents like patents and you know legal contracts were just you know and translating those from Japanese into English was for me a terribly tedious and boring job, but it paid well.
Okay,
and you know, I did that for quite some time.
It's always the golden handcuffs, right? How do you unshackle those and
Correct.
Move forward?
Correct. Well, in this case, you know, I was doing performances in the evenings or on the weekends. And I started the show at Harvey's house. We ended that after a little while. And then I moved the show to the National Arts Club, which is a little private club in Gramercy Park, which is also in Manhattan. It's a gorgeous old mansion, and it's an artists-only club. So you have to either be a performing artist like myself or a visual artist like a painter or a a sculptor. And or you could be like a literary artist, for example, a poet or a playwright, and they have the artwork of the club members all over.
I've seen it
in
the video where I saw Dick Cavett introducing you. The walls are covered.
Yeah,
in art.
Covered with art.
Beautiful.
It was just really stunning, and that was only one room within the entire venue. Anyway, so I did the show at the National Arts Club for quite some time, for about 2 or 3 months. And that was doing the shows just on Friday nights. And that was really selling out. I started to get media coverage, local news, and you know the New York Post covered this show, and suddenly I was selling out every show, you know, for a couple of months. But it gave me the idea that I've got something here.
Yeah.
That there's still a demand or a desire for this type of intermittent entertainment. And then I had the doors shut in my face because the National Arts Club closes, like many private clubs, in the summertime because all the members go away from Manhattan and go off to the Hamptons or their summer houses in some luxe location. And the club is closed to everyone, not just members, but to everyone. So it's closed to the public. And therefore, my new posh venue was gone.
You're gone. No, thanks
so
very
much. Was back on the street again.
Yeah.
And at the very last show that I did at the National Arts Club, there was a woman there who is now currently my manager. So this, we're talking back now, like, you know, 13 years. And she said, you know, you mentioned that you're looking for a new venue, because I said that at the last show. I said, this is my last show, everyone. If you have any ideas of places where I can continue, please introduce yourself after the show. I felt no, you know, qualms in saying that because I really was desperate.
I love that as an artist that you did that and that you were open and connected with your audience and you weren't ashamed and you weren't hiding. And you just, that's a great moment there. So you actually said that at the end of the show.
And it paid off because she had connections at the Waldorf Astoria because she had done several events there and knew a lot of the top executives. So she introduced me to those executives. I did some magic for them, like in their office, and then
that's got to be weird. Almost like an audition.
It was kind of an audition, but the executives were like, "Yeah, definitely, we'll do this, absolutely." And it was no question. It wasn't even like possibly. It was like, "Yes, we're definitely doing this." And so the very first show that I did at the Waldorf, I was on the 42nd floor. It was in the Royal Suite where the Duke and Duchess of Windsor used to live.
Yeah.
Okay, so talk about, you know, posh environment. It doesn't get any better than this.
Right.
You know, this is, you know, a room that rents for like, you know, $10,000 a night.
Yeah, and here you are.
And here I am coming in there with my magic show. and they're like, take it, do whatever you want with it. And I said, can I do two shows here, three shows? They're like, do as many, it's yours, do whatever you want with it.
Wow.
And so I started doing the shows there weekly, every Friday night. I did a 7 o'clock show, a 9 o'clock show, and a midnight show, three shows a night.
Wow.
And they were selling because I had that carryover from the National Arts Club.
Yeah.
So I was doing that for a little while, and then 9/11 hit, and that was a big drop for everyone in the city. But I did something.
Were you still working at? Were you still translating, or had you given that up?
I kind of gave it up at that point.
How difficult was that a choice for you to make?
Well, you know, I was making some money doing magic performances, you know, at various events, like you know, corporate functions and people's, you know, private events from here and there, hither and yonder, but. You know, I just was bored of the translation.
Right.
It kind of drove me nuts. So I stopped that altogether. So at that point, I was kind of what you would consider a starving artist. But I was making money, so I wasn't really starving.
Right.
And I didn't have any children. I was married, but I didn't have any children. And I lied to my wife for about a year, telling her that we were breaking even.
Oh, at the magic show.
I was telling her that the chamber magic at the Waldorf
was
breaking even, when in fact I was losing money every week because I hired a publicist.
Yeah.
And you know, when you have a publicist who's trying to get the word out, that doesn't come free. That comes at a high price.
So literally you're losing money.
So I was losing money every show for nearly 2 years. I put in, you know, a couple $100,000 of my own money that I had been saving up over the years.
I read somewhere that a blogger helped you get the show going. Is that true in New York?
Yeah, well, what happened was about 2 years into performing at the Waldorf, I struck it really lucky because an editor from a popular website came to see my show and wrote a blog post about it and sent it out as an email blast to all the followers of that site. And within a day or two, maybe a couple of days, I sold out a year's worth of Friday nights. So there's 52 weeks in a year, and I sold out 52 Fridays, basically, of every performance. And the problem is now that I'm like, wow, I've got job security. This is great.
Right.
Like, who in the magic world has job security? But the problem was that someone who wants to buy tickets to the show now, we'd have to wait till next year, and that's you know, no one's, you know, going to be expected to or even remember that. So I realized I had to start adding more shows on a different night.
Yeah.
So that I added not just Friday nights, but I added a Saturday night show as well. So now he's doing Friday nights and Saturday nights, two shows each night, so four shows a week.
And yeah, right away your cost of production goes up, but you figure you're doing okay.
Right, exactly. And yeah. But there was a demand for it. I mean, there really was a demand for it. Then about, I don't know, maybe less than a year later, CBS Sunday Morning, which is a very popular television show, which airs in the States. I don't know if you...
Do you
get that here?
Absolutely.
And it's a really great show, and they do thorough job. I love that show. And they came in and they filmed what became an eight-minute segment about me. It was like the ultimate, infomercial in a way, but it wasn't meant to be. It was meant to just be like a coverage of me as an artist. And so the moment that aired, we sold so many tickets to the show. It was like watching the dials on a slot machine start to spin around and around and around.
Yeah.
And the numbers were going up and up and up until I was realizing that it wasn't just my local area, but there are people from all over the country
planning their trips
who are now planning trips to New York to come see this.
So cool.
And so I had to add Saturday matinees now. Wow. So now I was doing five shows a week, two on Friday, three on Saturday. And that, you know, and within a couple of days, I sold over $1 million worth of tickets.
Oh, my God. In how many days?
In a day and a half.
That's so you really are the millionaire magician.
Well, it's worked out pretty nicely.
But now at some point you mentioned that, or I saw that you hadn't told your wife that you were not actually making money. So now you're making money. So this must at some point.
Now she knows.
How did you tell her? How did you say, by the way, remember breaking even? I wasn't.
It was when you're able to start saying yes when you're in the past. You used to have to say no.
That
I think is pretty clear that there's resistance.
A million in a weekend or so.
It was ridiculous. But then, this is actually, it's really been a blessing. And being able to do what you love and have people support that.
Of course.
It's really a two-way street. I love the show. I've done it over 3,000 times. But I love the beginning of every show because I know I'm going to be able to give these people a great time.
Yeah.
And then I get that positive feedback loop. I feel great because I know that I've given these people a good time.
Of course.
And, I think that there's probably a point in many entertainers' careers where they start to maybe look at someone, in Las Vegas who's been working for ages, for decades, and they say, okay, I'm burned out. I haven't gotten there.
Oh, I can see in your eyes you're excited.
I love this. And I have people who come to me and they say, I saw your show 8 years ago, and it's even better now. And I'm like, well, thank you for saying that. It's just I feel so comfortable doing it because it's become me. I think there's a lot of imitation in the arts.
Oh, especially in magic. It's so easy to do that.
And, people tend to mimic, their heroes. But I've done this now so many times that I really feel like I'm being myself.
Yeah.
And it's nice to be able to, as an artist, express yourself. And, no one tells you whether you're doing it right or wrong.
The only people
who tells you whether you're doing it right or wrong is the audience, because at the moment they're responding with joy or with glee. And also they also vote with their pocketbooks.
Of course, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I wouldn't be able to keep doing this show if I wasn't doing it right.
Absolutely.
So I'm doing something right.
Yeah.
And, I've never really sat down and tried to analyze it because, I just feel like I'm doing the right thing.
You talked about imitating.
It feels right to me.
And it's you. It's your own show. And you dug up, you went through history and sort of adopted some things from history and made some things your own. When you talked about people imitating, I don't know if you saw the story. I'm sure you did. A while back with Jeff McBride, really
an
amazingly innovative magician, the work he does with masks and kabuki. He basically took some parlor magic. You think about Cardini or that sort of thing and how he's applied all these different levels of art to that. And someone in Thailand that was on BBC literally copied Jeff McBride's act, image for image,
motion
move
for,
act
for move. Yeah, exactly. It was a complete ripoff of Jeff's act.
And it's hard for people outside of the magic community to appreciate how hard someone like Jeff or you have worked on your show over and over again. It's really a lifetime's work in that period of time.
Well, it's not just, for people who are listening to this who don't know who Jeff McBride is, he's an incredibly talented and innovative performer.
Mm-hmm.
And, the things that he has brought to magic as far as his technique and his, styling and his, his interdisciplinary approach is something that no one's ever done before.
No.
So then if someone comes in and just rips it off wholesale and starts presenting that as their act, if you were trying to do that, I suppose, as a tribute to the performer.
That was the question,
Maybe that would be, somewhat acceptable, or maybe it's someone young.
It doesn't really happen in magic.
But it's just, I think that magicians in general want to inspire other magicians to be unique,
right, yeah,
and not to rip off. And there's so much cattiness in amongst magicians about saying, oh, this belongs to so-and-so, or this right, move yeah, belongs to so-and-so, he originated that, or that came from this book in the 1700s, you know. And there's a lot of you know, historical precedence for where these tricks originated.
And you can track them down in the books.
Exactly. Yeah. And so for someone to come along and say, well, this is mine, when it's clearly not, it's blatantly not, you know, it's almost an insult to the originator.
To the art of magic, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, yeah, it's disappointing. And I have, you know, in my own case, I've had other magicians who have looked at my show and the success that I've gotten with the show and said, oh, well, I want that. I want that type of success. So I'm going to do exactly that kind of a show myself in my own city. Hmm. And then they start a show up, you know, in their own towns. And you know, I have no problem with that because, frankly, the format is not mine. Like I mentioned before, there was a magician named Hofzinser in right, Vienna who, you know, who was doing magic for small, intimate yeah, audiences yeah, of high society. So there's no one who has a patent or a copyright or a trademark on that, you know, format. But having said that, you know, I know how difficult it is. And you can't just expect to start up a show and suddenly everyone will flock to it forever.
As you said, 2 years at the Waldorf, barely breaking even, well, not breaking even.
Well, the problem is that, you know, you only have a limited sphere of influence. And you know so many people. You have friends and they have friends. But after that, it eventually stops, right? It's like, you know, this outer shell of how many people you actually know. And you can't crack through that shell unless you start going far beyond your own personal sphere.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my case, it was thanks to the media and then now purely just word of mouth.
Sure.
You know, because I've got, like I said, you know, I've got 5 shows every week. So there's a lot of ambassadors who are going around saying, you've got to go see this.
Yeah.
And these people are, you know, spreading the word for me.
And how do you plan for the next show? Have you got something up your sleeve? Because we should wrap up. Have you got something like 10 years? Do you see yourself? Where do you see yourself? At the Waldorf with a different kind of show? Or
well, the show actually is it's developed a lot over the years. It's really transformed. And I have a master plan to have the show run for 20 years. Hmm. So right now I've run 13 years of that. So I've got 7 more years to go. And that's just purely self-imposed because I thought it would be nice to say I worked 20 years at the Waldorf.
Wow, yeah.
And I'll buy myself a gold watch or something. but then after that, I don't know what I'm going to do after that. I've got so many projects I'm doing during it. You know, during the week, yeah. I made my own television show for the History Channel.
Absolutely.
That has aired in Canada multiple times on H2 channel. That's the History Channel that you have here called H2.
Right.
And that show is called Lost Magic Decoded. And so I've made that show. I also am now making a web series with my best friend. We're creating a 6-part miniseries, which stars me and has a whole dramatic story.
Oh, wow. It's a narrative.
A fictional story, but it's really about magic, and I think people are going to really love
it. Oh, that'd be fascinating.
And so, yeah, I've got a lot of interesting projects. I have my own book, and I'm writing a second book right now.
Okay.
And, you know, the first one was published by HarperCollins, so the next one will probably be also a similar.
What was the first one called?
It's called Win the Crowd.
So it's a nonfiction.
It's a nonfiction book about how magicians how non-magicians can use the ideas of a magician to become more charismatic and personable in their daily lives. Because when you strip away all of the sleight of hand tricks,
yeah, we're just magic, standing up in front of people.
Magic is all about talking to an audience,
absolutely,
and convincing them that what you're saying is true. And
yeah, so, yeah, that's right.
You know, who couldn't use that as a technique in their life?
Absolutely. Hey, that sounds so cool. So lots of things going on. So people who can't see you in Toronto will be able to see you in New York. How difficult is it to get a ticket online now? Just from
the tickets are usually sold out several weeks, if not months, in advance.
Okay.
During the summertime, it's actually a good time because,
oh, great.
You know, if people come to New York in the summer, there often are quite a few seats because a lot of New Yorkers go out of town.
Perfect.
So yeah, I'll be performing all through the summer and the fall and the winter and next spring and
Chambermagic.com is the place people can go to get tickets.
Yes, yeah, the tickets are available on online. The website is chambermagic.com. And on that site also people can watch videos. I was on the David Letterman show. You can watch all those videos.
Well, that's the first time I saw you, actually. Because I'm a huge Letterman fan. And I remember seeing that, and I hadn't seen anything like it before. I mean, it was just a great – and you could tell – and Dave – I don't think Dave likes magicians, but I could tell he liked you. That was so cool for me watching that because I love Dave. I've seen the show 3 or 4 times in New York. And so for me to watch him and for him to give you that sort of gesture that he does when he actually enjoys a guest, yeah, that was something else.
Yeah, he was great. Yeah, I had a great time with Letterman. And
how many tricks did you have to audition to – did they pick that one or did you just
zero.
Think this is what I'm going to do?
They said they wanted me on the show. And they said, just what are you going to do? And I said, this is what I'm going to do. And they said, fine.
Did you have to do it before them anywhere?
No, I just told them this is what I'm doing.
Wow. No rehearsing to camera or anything?
Well, I mean, I did one camera rehearsal without Letterman there. You only meet him when the cameras are rolling.
Gotcha.
Yeah. That's the same thing with most of the hosts, like Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
He didn't want to talk to the guests before the show. He would walk right as quickly as he could past their dressing room door, so he didn't have to say hello.
Yeah, there's nothing more fun than an audience member watching the host having fun, and you definitely made Dave laugh and have a good time. As you're doing well, that's the success. As you said, people come see your show, they have a good time, they laugh, they enjoy it. So I want to say I had a great time talking to you. I don't get to talk to magicians, period, magicians of your caliber. Almost, it's been ages. So thanks, Steve, for sharing the time
with
me. I appreciate it. And all the best to you with the ongoing ventures. We'll check out chambermagic.com. Take a look. What was the name of the book again?
The book is called Win the Crowd.
Win the Crowd, yeah. And keep an eye out for the web series. Will that be on Chamber Magic? Where will people find
it'll
that?
There'll be a lot of somewhere. Announcements. So if you're on my Facebook or Twitter, I'm on Twitter also at Chamber Magic.
Gotcha.
And there'll definitely be lots of information there.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Well, there you go. It was so cool to talk to Steve. What a nice guy, and just so generous and open with his time. As a youth, as I said earlier, I spent a lot of time with magicians, and it's been a long time since I've had a chance to talk to a magician of that caliber, and that was just a great experience for me. Yeah, magic is a wonderful hobby. I encourage anyone who has young kids, or if you're interested in doing something like that later in life, it's a great hobby to pick up. And there is a wonderful fraternity, and thanks again, Steve, for sharing your time with me. If you enjoy the podcast, by all means, leave a comment down on the comment page, or you can send us a voice message using the voice microphone on your computer. If you find the inadequatelife.com, you'll see there it says send us some feedback on the Say Hello page. Try that out. It's pretty cool. You don't need a phone, just a microphone that's on your computer, the microphone that you use to Skype. You can talk to us on that. If you're in Toronto, go to the Luminato Festival. You'll get to see Steve's show this week, if you're listening when the podcast was actually put up. If not, you can find him in New York at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Book early for reservations. It's a super busy show. Thanks again to everyone for listening. Don't forget, next week, Shalina Kennedy. She was the star of Stratford's critically acclaimed West Side Story. She was the star of Jesus Christ Superstar on Broadway. She's from Ontario, went to Sheridan College. And Shalina talked to me about her role in that play. Ted, the guy who created the show, is the man behind the critically acclaimed show Two Pianos, Four Hands, which was a huge international success. And people have great expectations, and we're all looking forward to seeing Evangeline. Shalina talks to us about that show and all kinds of other things next week on The Inadequate Life. I'm Keith Tomasek. Thanks for listening. See you next time.